Hello, and welcome to the TAA teleconference negotiation of author-publisher contracts for the experienced author, presented by Michael R. Lenny, an author's attorney and literary agent at Lenny Literary and Author's Attorneys in San Diego. Michael has negotiated hundreds of major contracts for both established and first-time authors of text and trade books. He regularly speaks at workshops and conferences around the country about current legal issues in publishing. Michael has also served many years on the TAA Council and has been an active member of TAA since its inception in 1987. He has made presentations, given workshops, and appeared on panels at TAA's annual conferences and has served as a legal advisor to TAA. According to Publishers Weekly magazine, Michael has negotiated one of the largest settlements recorded on behalf of textbook authors, and he has successfully litigated a number of other major author-publisher court actions. Michael is currently engaged in a project to gather textbook contracts to form a major database that will allow him to more effectively and efficiently negotiate contracts on behalf of TAA members. He will speak briefly about the project at the conclusion of our session. I will email all participants Michael's contact information following the teleconference. It will also be posted with the recording. I will now turn the teleconference over to Michael.
Well, thank you very much. That was a nice introduction. I appreciate it. I want to thank Kim and Jenny and all the TAA staff for setting up these sessions. I've attended the last two myself, and I know they've been very good. I'd like to thank all of those who are attending as well. I know a number of you, and this list of some 16 different items, we're going to have to keep moving to get through. I'm a little bit intimidated because I know some of you know as much or more than I do about them. Remind me as we go along if I don't call for questions. I'll try to do that fairly frequently so that they don't all build up and so they have relevance to the issue we've just discussed. Okay, so starting off, I think you all have a sort of outline of negotiation of author-publisher contracts for experienced authors, and it's divided into really three categories, and then this contract database project, which I'll say a few words about. But let's start with A, what are the hot current issues I need to be aware of to preserve and protect my royalties? And to give a little bit of background to this, I'm finding that more and more the publishers are finding very innovative ways to lower the amount of money they pay out to authors in royalties. It used to be much more upfront. We'd like to pay you a royalty of 10% instead of 12% or 15%, and that's because we just gone to four color, or we're adding a lot of supplements and those cost money, or we're going through a development phase, etc. Now they do the same thing, but you don't even know they're there. They're just sort of in and out, and you're short 20% of the royalty you would have otherwise gotten. So this is sort of making you familiar with some of those things. The first item we have on there, the Course Smart Syndrome, is a system by which some five different publishers, and maybe more at this point, have joined into a partnership. And what they do is they turn over the sales and some of the marketing to Course Smart. Okay, what's their goal in all of this is to save the big discounts that have to be paid to the bookstores. Why they can't just do that on their own websites, I don't know. But some of the things that happen coming out of that are of real concern, such as CourseSmart takes a profit off the top. before we get to the net royalties, there's something taken off the top by the publisher. So the 85% that they already get isn't enough. Besides that, the costs incurred by CourseSmart, the sales, are taken off before the net sum of royalties is determined, or the net revenues are determined. So they usually will pay you the same royalty rate. The problem is what that rate is being applied to is getting smaller and smaller. Now, in one respect, it's getting somewhat bigger also, because they don't have the discount to the bookstore. But since they're paying you on a net basis, you have to ask the question, net of what? You know, we're not giving the discount to the bookstore anymore. So if you find all this confusing, just imagine what opportunities it provides to your publisher's royalty department as to how they calculate your royalty. I have a lot of questions about this this program. There is no transparency to it. We have no idea how they arrive at the amount of money, revenues that you're being paid a royalty on. So there's a complete lack of transparency. They also offer a 5%, as I read their advertising. A professor who wants to adopt this book for his department will get a 5% discount, or a 5% of revenues. So that's another amount of money in the state being taken out, and it raises some real conflict of interest and some ethical issues as well. Now, CourseSmart so far has not been selling real well. So it's not taking a big chunk out of your royalties. However, each publisher besides that has their own course management, such as Pearson has my lab. So there'd be a My Math Lab or a My Biology Lab. Now, those raise many of the same problems. They don't raise the conflict of interest because it's all done in-house. But what you end up with through those course management programs is about 50% of the base that your royalty applies to. In other words, your royalty is cut in half when sold through these course management programs. So that's a real concern. Now, if Mike Sullivan's on board, Mike, when we break in a moment for questions, be sure to fill in some of the things I missed with regard to the my lab aspects of this.
Okay.
PubSups is the next category. And PubSups is, you probably haven't heard of, I was having a discussion with Mike last night, and after I said that, I said, well, you probably haven't heard of it because it's a term we made up. And what it is publisher supplements, as opposed to supplements that are put in a kit or a package by the publisher and written by an author who's paid a royalty. These are supplements that are prepared in-house. Now, the problem with PubSups is that the publisher is going to get basic, if we assume for purposes of this discussion that the author gets a 15% royalty, the publisher is getting the other 85%, right? Well, up until fairly recently, that's been enough for them. But now they're putting in these publisher supplements upon which they're not just getting the 85%, but they're getting paid a royalty to themselves for the supplement. The way this shows up is normally in kits. So a kit may be comprised of the textbook you wrote, maybe a study guide you wrote, and then there might be one or two publisher supplements. When the kit is exploded, and if you don't know what that means, that could be the subject of another discussion, probably has been with Paul Rosenzweig, the various components of the kit are allocated a certain amount of the royalties for purposes, or a certain amount of the revenues for purposes of royalties. So the textbook might get $60, and the study guide by the author might get another $15, and PubSup number one might get another $15 or $20, and PubSup number two might get something similar. So, of course, they don't physically pay themselves a royalty, but when the royalty is paid out, it gets distributed, in effect, to all of those components. The result is your two components out of those four components in a kit are going to end up with a reduced royalty. So publishers shouldn't be receiving a royalty on their own supplements, especially since a lot of those supplements are, you know, they're a questionable assistance in selling the book in some circumstances. They may be something that the publisher picked up and they thought they were going to do very well with selling standalone sales. They haven't done well with, so they stick it in a kit with a an author's materials. The third item under hot current issues, and I'll go through these four items. Well, let's stop there. That's kind of a breaking point. Any questions with regard to CourseSmart, MyLab, and PubSups at this point?
Michael, it's Paul Rosenzweig.
Hi, Paul.
The CourseSmart syndrome is really quite similar to what Pearson, as an example, has been doing with regard to school book depository charges. That is, they've been netting those out as a reduction of publishers' net receipts before applying the royalties. Now, my contention there is that that's a distribution cost or an administrative cost. It is not a reduction of PNR. To me, hearing the discussion of CourseSmart, yes, it's another channel of distribution, but from the accounting shenanigans involved, as you described it, it's the same thing as they have been doing with school book depository. Now, to the extent that colleges are not involved, college textbook authors haven't seen the effect of the depository thing, but high school and elementary have been whacked with it for years.
Mm-hmm. It's funny. When I first started this 20 years ago, the authors at a school level, six math authors, told me about a situation where CBS, Holt Reinhardt and Winston, had done that very thing. They'd masked it in the royalty statements, but they were charging for the depositories, for book depositories, and that was overturned. It's before I was involved in this. I don't know if it's a court case or just a big stink that was made, but that's a very good lesson. You can't sit by and watch these things happen. You have to raise a stink and get your fellow authors and co-authors to raise a stink also. A lot of the stuff that we're discussing in this first section just really is not, is very questionable under the contracts. And so if enough people get together and start complaining about it, we can make it not happen. Also, when the publisher gets called on these things, they become a little contrite, a little bit more forthcoming on occasion, and you may be able to negotiate something a little better in your next contract. Okay. Item three, unfair. Any other questions first before I go on? Okay, item three, an unfair trade. don't fall for a publisher's offer to give you an audit clause in exchange for a two-year look back. This has been going on for a while, but I see more intensity applied to it recently, particularly by Pearson. And Pearson incorporates New York law into all of their contracts. And New York law is usually pretty good to them, and besides that, they know the New York law, and they know what to expect. However, one of the provisions of New York law they don't like at all, and that is that there is a six-year statute of limitations for actions on an accounting. What can happen is 6 years after the fact, the author may hire somebody like Paul Rosenzweig, and he applies his famous smell test and says this stinks, and the author ends up not being able to negotiate a settlement with the publisher and ends up filing a lawsuit. Well, this 6 years is a long time from event to a lawsuit, and the publisher is very concerned about that long, long window. So the other half of this is authors would like to have a power of to conduct an audit. So they ask for an audit clause. That's a good thing, an audit clause. Might even have a provision that shifts the cost of the audit to the publisher if the error is 5% or more in favor of the publisher on the audited period. So what they are doing is saying, well, look, we don't like to do this, but we'll give you that audit clause. But what we ask for in exchange, since you'll be able to audit our books, is that you agree that if you don't audit or don't call to our attention any errors that you feel are involved in our royalty statements within 2 years of issue of the royalty statement, then you're banned from doing so. So what's that mean? I'm afraid it means that your six-year statute of limitations incorporated by New York law in that agreement now becomes a two-year statute of limitations. And the publisher has, in effect, said, we like New York law. It's all going to apply to you, even though you live in Topeka or in San Diego, except for this one provision we don't like, and we're going to carve that one out. So the response to that request is no thanks. The audit clause isn't that important to you. I mean, it's nice. You'd like to have it. But as a trade for a six-year statute of limitations compared to a two-year, you say absolutely not. What you do say is, look, you guys are the ones who adopted New York law. I'm going along with that. That's fine. You got to choose the law, but let's stick with it, not just cherry pick out the things you don't like. Okay. And besides all of that, you have, in my opinion, an audit right with or without the clause. Now, you don't have the right to shift costs that I mentioned a moment ago, but you do have the audit right. They have all the books. They receive all the money. They pay out and give royalty statements. You have a right to look at those books. Okay. Item number four, kit and kit within a kit. Magic number mischief. This is a subject that we could spend at least 2 or 3 hours on, and it might be a good subject for a workshop. But many of you, being the successful authors that you are, have dozens. Some of you I know have hundreds of different ISBN numbers. And those represent basically the same text, or maybe 2 or 3 or 4 different texts, but packaged differently with your supplements, with co-author supplements, and with these pub subs. So a lot of mischief can be achieved in the royalty department with all of these different ISBNs and all of these different packages. And the author's supplements can, as we found out through some audits, can get lost in this maze. Sometimes the author's supplements will end up being valued at zero when the kit is exploded. So the publisher gets credit for his pub sup. The author doesn't get credit for his own supplement. It may be that it's not given a zero value, but it's given a very low allocation as compared to what would be the market value for that, or what is the standalone price for that, or what the publisher sup's getting for his supplements. So kit and kit within a kit, without spending that 3 hours or so, is a big potential debit to your royalties. And if you're suspecting any of that happening, or you have an awful lot of kits and kits within kits, have somebody take a look at it who has the credentials to know what's happening. And there are, I know, a couple of firms, Paul Rosenzweig being one of them, that do that kind of work and can help you in that regard. Okay, any questions on those last two items in Section A?
Michael, it's Paul again.
This is Judy Rasminski. How do you know whether your book is being offered in a kit? And how do you know whether it's being offered under CourseSmart?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can go to the CourseSmart website. You can go to the publisher's website and go to their catalog and just see how many different ways your book is put together. Paul, you have anything else on that?
Yeah, in answer to Judy's question, but it touches on the same point. It certainly at Pearson and in most publishers, you don't see the kits on your royalty statement, because what you see is the exploded proceeds and the breakout by ISBN of the original items. But Michael is correct. If you go to their website, if you look at their marketing materials and compare the ISBN in the marketing materials and on the website with the ISBN on your statements, you'll see different ISBNs. You're not familiar with those. Those are the kits. And that, once you see or know from a marketing standpoint that your work is out there in kits, you have a problem. Now, I did want to jump in on one other thing, Michael, and that is on item three. Unfortunately, a major publisher, and that is McGraw-Hill, denies that you have that inherent right to an audit, whether or not you have an audit clause or not. For several years now, and despite some urgings to get the Authors Guild involved, McGraw-Hill has consistently denied the right to audit to any author who doesn't have a specific audit clause in his or her contract.
That's a position that should be challenged.
Yeah, I know, but now we get into the problem of who's going to pay the cost of it, because the Authors Guild wouldn't undertake it, and no single author that I've run into has had enough invested to pick
it up.
Should be
a single author bit, because it's affecting everybody who writes for them. But let's talk about that offline.
Okay,
no
problem.
I'm not saying that the publishers willingly will say, oh, yeah, you have this unwritten right to audit. But under the law, you do. When one party has all of the ability to determine what revenues are, what royalties are, they have all the records. They have the records of sales. They have, they set the prices. They absolutely are required to make their books open for audit. So I think legally that's a pretty easy one, but it sounds like McGraw-Hill is stiffing authors anyway. Okay, I'm going to move on to
B. Could I ask a question, Michael?
Sure.
Ray Andre. I just want to go back to the publisher supplements. And I was advised that if I selected a publisher supplement and packaged it with my book, I would sell more books because then the students could not buy used books. Now, you know, I didn't do that, but I'm just wondering how that particular strategy fits with what you're saying. I mean, does that raise red flags for you in terms of royalties also?
Well, first, I'm very impressed that they asked you before just doing it. But what you wanted, all the author really requires is some being upfront and showing how this is going to work. You can say, what is the PubSup? How will it be priced in the package? What effect's that going to have on how much royalty I receive? And get that in writing. And then you can evaluate it. But otherwise, there's no way for you to determine whether that's really in your interest or not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if there aren't any other questions, we're into this about 30 minutes at this point, and really we've probably only accomplished a third, so we'll try to pick it up a bit. But I wanted to focus on those kind of things because they're the kind of issues that you don't think about. They don't come up and hit you in the face. So category B, as a successful textbook author, what should be my focus in negotiations? And what I've tried to focus on here are the things that because of your clout, because of your status as an experienced and successful author, you may have a better ability to obtain than somebody who's just starting out. So electronic rights, this is where the industry is headed, and so this has to be considered right at the top of the list. Electronic rights are being grabbed up by publishers. They have, on the trade side, they haven't quite made the breakthrough yet. I think the present economy, plus these Kindle readers and Amazon readers and things, are going to be the spark that's needed on the trade side. We're already seeing on the textbook side a number of uses of electronic rights, and they're particularly useful. And I was an engineer before I became an attorney, and I can just imagine some of the courses that would be so much more understandable if put in an interactive form and digitized. So you have to pay a lot of attention to how electronic rights is dealt with in your contract. The preferred way is if there is current digital use, that you negotiate the contract for that digital use and the royalty rate for that digital use, and that you provide a reopener for that. If I'll come back to that in a minute. If there's not a current use, but the publisher just wants electronic rights, the thing to do is to say that those will be negotiated at the time that you have a use we can consider. Now, falling into the same type of negotiation is the clause that's in every contract now that says something to the effect that we can publish this in every format, through every channel, whether now existing or later discovered or formed. With regard to that clause, you want to not agree to that if you have the clout to get away with that, and many of you do. What you would say is that you would add to that language something to the effect that no new channel, or in particular no new medium for publication will be used with this work unless royalty rate and terms are negotiated with the publisher, which consent will not be unreasonably withheld. So what you want to do is learn about these things, and if it turns out that this particular medium is going to be much cheaper for the publisher That means there's more money to go around, and you as the creator should receive some of it. So what you're trying to do throughout in negotiating contracts is not sign blank checks. You want to know what it is that you're giving up, what it is you're going to get. And if they haven't even discovered the medium yet, you have no idea. You're just whistling in the wind. Electronics rights, coming back to that, is an area, medium through which the publisher saves tremendous amounts of money. You know, when you don't have to print, you don't have to ship, you don't have to distribute, these are the primary costs that the publisher incurs. Now, they'll come back and tell you, well, yeah, but we've got to develop these projects and these new means of distribution. That's true for the first time, but it's not true thereafter. So electronic rights demand, really, from the author's side, that you assert for yourself and that you demand higher royalties. And if you can't get them now, then put in a provision that I'll agree to 18% for electronic rights, or I'll agree to 15% for electronic rights. However, we'll have a reopener on the next edition of this with regard to the royalty rates, so that if these things do settle out, and they will, you can renegotiate to a reasonable royalty rate. Okay, so that's only the first item, but we've kind of touched on the second item under B, reopeners. Reopeners are good for things like CourseSmart. I'm negotiating very high royalty rates in those contracts that I'm negotiating or agreeing to CourseSmart. And besides the high royalty rates, I'm negotiating that the royalty rate will be reopened after some specific period of time. My lab could be another one through Pearson where there'd be a reopener after there's more information on the table. Advances. Publishers traditionally give advances for the first edition, don't want to give them for subsequent editions. Rather than just agreeing to that in the contract, you could say that future advances will be the subject of negotiation between the parties. Right of approval or right of consultation, and I know that you probably got questions piling up here, but I don't want to be in a position where we're only 50% done by the time the standard time is up. So right of approval or right of consultation. I wrote an article under the heading Injure for TAA probably a year ago or more on this subject, but a right of consultation is not a legal right. So you put in the in your contract that you have the right to see the cover art and photography before it goes to press. Okay, what does that mean? The publisher could say, well, here's the cover art, here's the photography, and you come back in 5 days later and say, that's the worst cover art I've ever seen in my life. I don't want to have my name associated with that. And the publisher, and I'm talking legally now, can say, well, we were required to consult with you. We did. And we don't really care that you don't like it. That's what we're using. They're not going to be quite that blunt. But I'm trying to demonstrate what a right of consultation is. However, as a practical matter, the publisher is going to be more responsible. If they have to show you these things, they know that your feelings and your senses, which you probably expressed to them in the past, should be taken into account. And as a result, you're going to get more control over these things, even though you couldn't take it to a court of law and say, I demand that they replace this cover. So the same reasoning applies to things like selection of supplement authors, a marketing plan you ought to be able to see before it's implemented, an advertising copy, probably a number of other things that I'm not mentioning that could fall into this category as well. So if you really have lots and lots of clout, you don't ask for a right of consultation. You ask for a right of approval, and that's accompanied by the words, which approval will not be unreasonably withheld. But for most of us, a right of consultation is not a bad backup. Okay, let's take a couple of questions, bearing in mind that we have five more items under B, and then we have four items under C. So, questions. Okay, everybody wants to go on. Reserving the right to hire an assistant. You know, this isn't something that everybody's going to get. But some of you at the in the top of your fields will be able to do this. And you don't necessarily have to be at the top of your field. You just have to develop some good arguments to the publisher that you can get a lot more done if you're able to have an assistant help you with these things. Now, why do you even have to talk to the publisher about that? It's because of the indemnity clause and the warranty clause, wherein you say that you've created all of these things. So if an assistant is creating some of them and you don't clear that through the publisher, there could be some problem. But it's probably something that you're going to be able to get their agreement on, because it's going to make for a better product. And it's going to allow you to, one, train somebody who you might be able to bring along as a co-author in the future if you ever want to retire, and you know, get things done faster to meet the deadlines. Scaled royalty rates. If these are being offered, they can be a good way to go. Basically, a scaled royalty rate, if it's three-tier, should have at the middle the rate that you feel you should be getting all along. You know, maybe that's 15% for the print edition of the book, depending on what kind of book you're publishing. And then if you agree to some percentage less than that, say 12.5%, the number of copies that have to be sold under that category need to be limited. Maybe if you have a book that sells a lot, you on the first 5,000 copies, you'd agree to 12.5%. On the next 10,000, 15,000, you'd agree to 15%, and thereafter you'd agree to 17.5%, or the old number used to be 18.75%. But basically what you want to do when you do the math is have those rates applied to the number of sales in each category, come out to where you're at least receiving your basic 15%, and you have a chance to share in the profits that are made if it becomes a barn burner. Okay, let's see. Never allow a reduction in your royalty rate. But once again, if you do, if you find they find you in a weak moment, that they just have to do this because this is an experimental book and they're going to incur a lot of cost to get this edition out. Just think about what they're saying. They're saying that there's going to be a lot of upfront costs for this edition. That doesn't apply to the next edition. But the publisher will write in that you're accepting this lower royalty rate for the third edition and thereafter. So you want to be alert to that. You're not going to do that. If for some reason you do accept a lower royalty rate, and I recommend against doing that, it would be on the basis of this edition only, and the rate will return to the normal rate, or even higher in future editions. Canadian royalty rates, all of you who sell well and make money for your publisher should be able to include that in the base royalty rate. That is, there is not significant additional cost to the publisher to sell in Canada. I don't know about now since September, but often they make greater profits on those Canadian sales. So there's no reason for you not to be receiving the domestic rate. Maybe some of you have even negotiated higher rates. I don't know. The retirement plan, sort of tongue-in-cheek. that goes back to hiring this assistant also. And there's a handout on both right to hire an assistant and revision clause. Basically, the revision clause provides sometimes that in the event that you don't participate in future editions, that nonetheless you will receive a certain percentage of your royalties, and that phases out normally. What I'm suggesting, in the past, it used to be quite often 50% on the first edition you don't participate in. You get 50% of the royalties you'd otherwise get, 25% in the second such edition, and nothing thereafter. My suggestion is that you get 60% on the first edition you don't participate in, 30% on the second, and 15% thereafter, no matter whether there's 25 editions or five editions. Why? Because if the book continues to sell under your name, under the title that was given to it while you started the book, it's based on goodwill that you've imbued this book with. And you and your heir should always be entitled to something coming out of that. Publisher can always start a new book with new authors, new title, and you get nothing from that. But if it's based on your original book, you and your heirs should always receive something. Okay. One more item under B. Is there a difference in strategy between negotiating a contract for a new book versus for a new edition? And it's kind of a yes and no answer. We don't have time to spend a lot of time on this, but a new book, you're starting from scratch. You're in a courting phase. They really want to sign you and have you do this book. One clause in your first contract is going to be that for future editions, the provisions will all apply to future editions. And they'll probably say, except for advances, then that clause will not carry on. We've talked about that. However, the bottom line is this. If you don't submit manuscript, they don't have the next edition, unless they're unhappy with the work you did. And hopefully that's not going to be the case. So there's always an opportunity to negotiate for a better contract in subsequent editions. It's a little bit harder than it would be initially, and it's much more dependent upon how well your book produced. I wanted to refer to a couple of things on this. On one thing to watch out, well, this comes into Section C, actually. Okay, let's open it up for any questions, and then we'll go through Section C.
Mike, I actually have a question. It's John Byers at Maryland.
Okay.
And I'm a relatively new author, at least new with this publisher. And your last point, the difference between, or is there much of a difference between the strategy of negotiating a contract for a new book versus renegotiating for subsequent editions? I'm at a point where I had Pearson. I was with Prentice Hall. When they merged, now I'm with an editor on the Addison Wesley side, and the project is still in manuscript phase. My first editor signed me with, for lack of a better way of putting it, just an exploitive contract. It was awful. And my new editor has said such, and he's pretty experienced in the field. And I trust that point, at least, that he's made. And so I'm in the process of trying to renegotiate the sort of original contract and not even bother with amendments. And without monopolizing too much of your time, or at least here, because I plan on talking to you offline later on, is how might I begin to approach or what would be some broad stroking points that you might offer here about approaching the sort of revisiting the original contract, not through amendments, but through a complete revamp, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, well, the answer to that question is lengthy because the contracts are lengthy. There's probably about 25 clauses to them. What are some of the most important? Revision clause, which we're going to talk about in just a moment, not only for the retirement aspects of it or the phase-out aspects of it, but with regard to also whether or not you really have the right to do the new additions. Competing works clause is very important. Grant of rights clause, very important. And, of course, all the money items, the royalty rates, and particularly the electronic rates, and whether any of these things can be opened up again in subsequent editions. That's about as much time as I can give that right now and still.
Here's the quick question, I guess, then, that you could probably – is it not unprecedented to scrap a contract and be able to start from scratch with the same publisher, but obtaining someone like yourself and their expertise to look over a new contract and start clean?
That's not unusual. The publisher, of course, would like to stick with their highly leveraged contract in favor of the publisher. You know, I've got – it may not be news to most of you, but – all of these contracts are awful.
They are.
they make insurance contracts look like they've been negotiated at arm's length. These are terrible contracts, and you really have to pay attention and negotiate them. Okay, let me get through C, and then I'm willing to stick around for questions after that. But
Michael, this is Fred Kleiner. One quick question. I've talked to you about this separately at a conference or two ago. It has to do with the retirement plan. I don't think it's really kicked anyone yet. But a long-term concern that I think we all have to look out for is when we move to e-books, what constitutes a revision and a new edition? I mean, right now we may be thinking about 3, 4, 5 year cycles for textbooks. What happens if you're asked to revise the online text of an e-edition every 6 months or every year? Would that eat up very quickly your retirement plan once you stop writing?
Yeah.
I think we have to be aware of that long term.
Okay, well, that's something we should pay attention to and perhaps come up with a new clause for the revision. What is defined as a revision of an e-book? Because, you know, it can be a revision every 6 months or something. And the answer to your specific question is yes, it would eat up, depending on how it's defined, it would eat up the fat phases, the 60%, 30%. But if the 15% is evergreen, that is, if it applies to every edition, you'd still be receiving something. But that would be an unfair situation. So, you know, we need to talk about a clause that does a better job on that. Okay. If there aren't any other...
Yes, this is Amy. I have a question about the contract, new editions.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to have a contract with each new edition? Because I've done 3 editions without a new contract, and then the last one, because it was a new publisher, they wanted another contract, and I said, well, I haven't done that before. So I was just wondering, one, what's normal? And two, they are asking me to do a new edition every 2 years instead of 3. And there's nothing in the contract to say how many years, and I'm wondering, how can I go to 3?
What's the subject matter of the contract?
It's
the book.
The book is it's a nutrition food book, textbook.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of change in that, like political science, but you know, a contract is an agreement between 2 or more parties. That's it. I've just defined a contract. It has certain elements, an offer, an acceptance, consideration, amounts paid, that sort of thing. But so it can include anything. You know, your imagination is the only limitation. Now, the publishers have their standard contracts, but anything that occurs to you as an issue could be included. And whether you're going to get it or not depends, one, on your skill in negotiating, and two, your clout with that publisher. So setting a minimum amount of time between editions, or setting a maximum amount of time between editions so that you don't fall behind the competition. are both things that could be negotiated in a contract. Are they normally? No. Are they occasionally? Yes. By whom? By the sort of people who are in on this conference call. Okay. Any others? Okay. Go
yes, ahead. I have one. This is Blake Peterson from BYU.
Okay.
One question, I'll actually have two, but one, on the Canadian royalty rates, our royalty rates are the same. However, the wholesale value of the book seems to be about a third of what it is when they sell it in the U.S. Is that common, or is that?
Yeah. Is this, who's the publisher?
Wiley.
Okay. Is the Canadian edition being sold through some subsidiary of Wiley's?
Oh, that I'm not sure about.
Okay, this is an old question that Paul Rosenzweig and I have dealt with a lot of times, and so many times that I'm not mentioning it now, but it's the question of who is the publisher.
Mm.
So if Wiley is selling to Wiley Canada, and they consider that the point of sale, well, that point of sale is just a straw man. It can be the price can be anything they want to choose. So
okay.
To lower the royalty rate, the royalty to the author, they can pick an arbitrarily low number. So
mm-hmm.
let's say it's an $80 book sold in the United States. In Canada, usually they sell for more. And once again, I'm not keeping up on the exchange rates, so I don't know what's happening on that, but. So let's say that $80 book would sell for $95 in Canada. However, they sell it, the right hand sells to the left hand, Wiley Canada, for $60 or $50 or $40. And they often do those kind of discounts. Well, that's a meaningless sale. What you need to do is define the publisher in such a way that it includes all of their subsidiaries and affiliates. That takes care of the problem. You can also have a provision that says that the publisher will deal at arm's length with affiliates, meaning that they have to make a legitimate sale to that author. Or you can provide that your royalty will be paid on the basis of the ultimate sale by the affiliate.
The second quick question I have, I was just looking online and saw that my latest edition, there's an ebook version of it, and I didn't know that it existed and haven't heard anything with regards to the contract that we have with them.
Okay, well, that's the first embarrassment. The second embarrassment is if they not only don't tell you about it, but they don't pay you for it. So get ready for that one. I'm being a little flippant, but those sorts of things, you really have to keep track. As I said before, go to their websites and look at their catalogs and see what they're selling. And if those ISBNs aren't showing up on your royalty statement, you've got a problem.
Okay.
And that just happens much, much too often.
So we would need to go in and renegotiate to cover ebooks.
Well, if your current contract doesn't cover ebooks, I would be very surprised, unless it's a very old contract, pre-1995, say.
Okay.
But it probably does, but still, they need to report at least by ISBN number to you what it is they're selling.
Okay.
And you need to look and see what those ISBN numbers represent, what it is, what form, what format, what channels to sale. What was I going to say? You could, along the lines of a contract is an agreement between two or more parties, you could try to negotiate a royalty statement that designates and calls out the number of electronic sales. I wish you good luck on that one.
Actually, our royalty statement does show that, but what I don't know is what the rates are, and that hasn't ever been discussed, so that's my concern.
Okay, well, find out, and if it's something different than what your base rate is, you want to look very carefully into that.
Okay, thank you.
Look at your contract and see what it calls for, what royalty rate it calls for in the contract for e-sales also.
Okay,
any others?
Yeah,
for
Michael? Mike Sullivan?
Hi, Mike.
Hi. I wanted to go back to the course management system.
It's intriguing. And
well, here's my question. Pearson, with their My Labs, that's their course management system, and what they're doing right now is taking the revenue from a sale and attributing 50% of it to the My Math Lab or My Lab part of their company, and the other 50% is being attributed to revenue to the underlying title. My question, because we have all of these people on this call, is what are all the other publishers doing? Pearson's doing a 50-50 split on it. What are the other companies or the other publishers doing?
Mike, say just briefly what that 50-50 split means insofar as your royalty.
Well, it cuts it in half.
Yeah.
It cuts it in half. Yeah.
So the publisher, once again, not satisfied with getting 85% of the revenues, is going to take 50% off the top and then take 85% of the remaining 50.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's horrible.
It is. But my question is, what are other publishers doing?
Okay, anybody have comments on that? I'd like to know the answer to that question also, and if anybody has more information after we conclude the talk here, please feel free to contact me, contact Mike, we need to. The publisher does a very good job of keeping authors in the dark, and we need to share this information.
This would be something that we should probably share on our listserv in some fashion.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that nobody's responding, I assume, means that perhaps they don't know. And the question that needs to be asked of the publisher, how are you treating revenue from the sale of these course management products?
Mm-hmm.
And that might give us an idea that there are different models besides this Pearson model out there.
Right. There may be some more author-friendly models, although
Michael,
I'd be a little surprised.
Michael, it's Paul.
Yeah.
I have a question on the from you and Mike Sullivan. Why is My Labs and the use of another Pearson entity any different than who is the publisher?
I don't think it is. I think they're just redefining and getting away with it. You know, these are publisher costs. That's why they get the big bucks, the 85%.
But it's a self-dealing through with another affiliate.
Mm-hmm.
That's
the
way I view it. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Okay, before we go on with any more questions, I've got to at least mouth these four items in C. So as a new textbook author, what should be my focus in negotiations? And as I say, these are actually, they're applicable to all of us, but the new authors in particular need to avoid getting crippled by some of the things that the publishers put in their off-the-shelf contracts. So item two, the best negotiation leverage device, and this applies to everybody, is have multiple publishers. When you go out to buy a car, do you just go to one dealer and say, I'd like to buy your car? You don't do that. You go to multiple dealers and you negotiate from one to the other, and you get this additional item that the first publisher wasn't giving. So that's going to result in the best contracts for you. Getting multiple publishers interested. And you can't really do that when you're in the second, third, tenth edition. You got to do that when you're starting the book. How to avoid having your textbook authoring career in shackles before it begins. And there's a couple of things I want to talk about just quickly on that.
Hey, Michael, this is Jenny. Can I jump in real quick?
Yeah.
I want to let everybody know that we'll be sending out your contact information in the email following the teleconference, and that as long as you have time and there's questions that need to be answered, we can continue for a while longer.
Okay. Okay, good. Two clauses I just want to point out quickly. Competing works is one that can really tie up a new author. If the clause reads something like, just a moment, during the term of this agreement, you agree not to publish or agree to publish or furnish to any other publisher any work on the same subject matter of the work which will, in the publisher's judgment, conflict or interfere with publisher's sale, distribution, or use of the work under this agreement. Well, that is just so broad that they can say no to anything else you want to write, and you have become a captive employee of that publisher. So most people who write about math aren't qualified to write about nutrition. So being prohibited from writing anything else on the same subject is a killer. What you need to do is say that I'm not going to write another graphing geography book marketed primarily to undergraduate students at 2 and 4 year schools. So that's a clause that's of particular importance to a new author. Another is the revision clause quite often does not provide for you, and I have this under the heading, how to avoid having your textbook authoring, help, my textbook's been kidnapped and I've been kicked off the island. Okay, a revisions clause often reads, if we consider it in the best interest of the work to publish a revision, you agree to revise the work or any part of the work as requested by us and in accordance with the schedule we request. Okay, well, that's fine. You've agreed to revise it if they ask you, but they're not committed to ask you. So you've created this wonderful book in first edition, and they decide that now that you've done all that work, they can bring somebody in at a much cheaper royalty and carry on with the second through 12th editions. That clause has to say that you have the first right to revise the work. Okay. Contract database, we're trying to get as many contracts as we can, both off-the-shelf contracts from the publisher and those you've successfully negotiated. So please email those to me at michael@lennyliterary.com, or if you don't have an electronic copy, send them by mail. My address is available through TAA. Thank you very much for your attention. I've enjoyed this. If anything, I would probably cut down on the number of issues. There's so much meat here that it's difficult to get through all of it. So thank you again.
This has been an educational presentation brought to you by the Text and Academic Authors Association.